Hello and welcome to the Nourish Balance Thrive podcast. My name is Christopher Kelly and today I'm joined by Richard David Feynman. Richard is a professor of cell biology at the State University of New York Downtown Medical Center in Brooklyn, New York. His current interest is in nutrition and metabolism, specifically in the areas of diet composition and energy balance. His work in this area is stimulated by and continues to influence his teaching at the medical school, where he is a pioneer in incorporating nutrition into the biochemistry curriculum. Dr. Feynman is also the founder and former editor-in-chief of the journal Nutrition and Metabolism. Dr. Feynman has a BA from the University of Rochester and holds a PhD in chemistry from the University of Oregon. That's quite an intimidating bio, and I'm a tiny bit nervous now interviewing you, but thank you so much for coming on to the show, Richard.
My pleasure.
The reason I wanted to have you on was I've not long finished reading your new book, The World Turned Upside Down, The Second Low-Carbohydrate Revolution, which describes how the science of carbohydrate restriction arising from a ragtag collection of popular diets created the powerful low-fat, defeated the low-fat army and became the default approach to health, which I think is a fantastic book. Thank you so much for writing that. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, I'm glad.
There's a kind of a dry humor that runs throughout the book, which I really appreciated. And I think this paragraph from the book really sums it up. Nutrition in crisis. Almost every day, a new study shows that you're at risk for diabetes or cardiovascular disease or all-cause mortality brought on by a newly appreciated toxin, which turns out to be something that you just had for lunch. Now, I can't say the number of times I've had this happen to me.
Yeah.
So, tell me, what inspired you to write the book?
Well, to some extent, it's like the question as to why people climb mountains, because it was there. I've been teaching nutrition and metabolism for a long time, and as I mentioned in the book, I'm a person who's been fighting fat most of my life. Mm-hmm. And it's as in the passage that you read, you can't avoid running into the political effects. So all of those things were there. I would say it was difficult to write the book because they're all so intertwined. Mm-hmm. And also, I think that it's the problem we have is that we have a lot of experts who are not really knowledgeable, and we've been getting a lot of advice that is not really helpful.
Yeah, I would completely agree. And just to give you a tiny bit of backstory, that's how I arrived at this place. For most of my life, I really didn't feel very good at all. And obviously, I grew up in the UK and ate a lot of packaged foods, a lot of foods which I know that I'm now very sensitive to. And most of what I knew about nutrition came from my parents, and most of what they knew came from just the mainstream media. And so they spent a bunch of time with a paper towel, mopping the fat off of bacon and throwing away perfectly good fat that had just been cooked out of meat and that type of thing. And by the time I got to 30 years old, I was a real wreck of a human being. And, I looked to the internet, just the blogs, really, for more information about why this might be happening to me. And I stumbled across a few people whose message really resonated with me. And I followed their advice. And many of them you will have heard of, people like Chris Kresser and Mark Sisson, and Dr. Peter Attia, and a handful of others. And really for no other reason than authority, I suppose, which might be considered a really poor choice for listening to what someone has to say, I followed their recommendations and got spectacularly better, and then wondered whether anyone else would also be affected by those sorts of recommendations to not eat a low-fat diet, for example. And I was right. So I'm now reached the point where I'm running a business helping people implement those or similar changes to the ones that I made, and getting also fantastic results. But now I don't really know how to dig into this deeper and fully understand exactly why these recommendations from the experts are working. And so obviously the first place you turn is are the scientific studies, and it seems like the whole thing is a mess. Do you think that's true, or that's the goal of this interview, is to give me the tools that I need?
Of course it's a mess. I think the title of my book, or the subtitle, that it's the second low carb revolution, is actually accurate, because things are changing every day. I am concerned that I will not have promoted my book before the revolution's over. That's actually a joke. The Nutrition Society in the United States, which has renamed itself the Academy of Nutrition and Dietetics, and is abbreviated AND, mm-hmm. has criticized the U.S. Department of Agriculture recommendations, saying that they should pull back on their condemnation of saturated fat. Well, that's astounding. I mean, they, of course, say it in passing, in low key, without making a big noise about it, because it's outrageous. They've spent, they and the USDA and Harvard School of Public Health and everybody else has spent 40 years condemning saturated fat. And if you're changing your point of view now, the question is why? You know, what was the problem before, and what's happened since? So it's all changing, but what I didn't describe in my book is how the American Revolution is not really characteristic of revolutions. Political revolutions tend to be more like the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, or for that matter, the Libyan Revolution, and usually involve extensive reigns of terror. And there's going to be a lot of feedback here. And I think you had sent me an article that you wanted to discuss, and I think I talked you out of it.
Right. So that was I've gotten great results by not following these guidelines to restrict saturated fat. And, I wanted to dig into this deeper, and I bought myself a book on biochemistry that was recommended to me by a doctor that I very much respect. And within two pages of opening it, there it is. Saturated fat should be limited to 30% of calories, cholesterol no more than 300 milligrams. And then I'm wondering, can I really trust anything else in that book when I know that's those two statements alone, within a couple of pages are probably wrong. And at the same time, when somebody sends me an article that suggests that high fat diets are dangerous in the long term, I want to be able to investigate those claims and understand whether or not it's true. And I'm a computer scientist. My degree is in computer science, but I've never done science. That's not what computer scientists do. It's a bit of a misnomer, really. If anything, they're engineers. And I really don't think that science is intuitive to people. The thing that they really do understand is storytelling, right? So I heard about this guy that ate a high fat diet and he had a heart attack. That's something that people understand and they remember. So what are the general public to do at this point?
Alternative to nutrition expertise is you've got to go out there and research all the stuff yourself.
Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, chapter 16 of your book provides a useful framework. And it starts with this idea of the first three rules, which I think are really interesting. And those three rules are, if you're okay, you're okay. If you want to lose weight, don't eat. If you have to eat, don't eat carbs. If you have to eat carbs, eat low glycemic carbs. And three, if you have diabetes or metabolic syndrome, you have to try a low carb diet first. So how does someone know if they're okay? That's my problem with that.
Well, if you're not overweight and you get some exercise and you feel okay, then you probably are okay. If you want to try a different diet, you can see if you feel better. You know, the first recommendation is actually surprising to my students and some people. I'm not truly a low carbohydrate advocate. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, we don't really, what we know about anything in diet is much less than what we don't know.
Right.
My real criticism of the low-fat, the low-fat hysteria is that it prevents us from ever finding out what's good or bad about high fat or high saturated fat. We don't see any real risk. But who knows? Maybe there is something for some people in some situations where saturated fat may not be good. Certainly, it's not good if you also keep carbohydrate high. But the real problem is that, you know, by crying wolf, you know, we've been prevented from really finding out what's going on. So you got to judge yourself. If you feel okay, you feel okay. Now, if you think that what I'm describing in my book is compelling, then it's at least worth trying a low carbohydrate diet of some kind. Mm-hmm. And
then, how do you define low carbohydrate? Out of interest, like, how do you mean relative to like a standard American diet or low in terms of a number of grams?
Yeah, well, I think there's a continuum, and it depends who you are. A lot of people are clearly not sensitive to relatively high carbohydrate intake. I have recognized since I was a child that I am, and right now, if I have more than 100 grams of carbohydrate a day, I don't feel good. But there are lots of people who, if they don't have at least 100 grams, don't feel good. So you have to decide that for yourself. The area where we know a lot is in terms of therapy. There's nothing better for losing weight. It's the easiest way to do it. It involves the least hunger. And it's probably the very safest way, as indicated by the fact that the medical establishment has spent 40 years trying to find something wrong with it. And if they couldn't, that's probably the best certification you could get.
Right.
But there are lots of other ways to lose weight. I mean, as I mentioned, I've been fighting fat since I was a child. And when you're, you know, when you're 20 years old, there's 100 different things you could do. I remember inventing the nothing but fruit before 5 o'clock diet. And if you're 20 years old, that's going to work great. As you get older, that's not going to be as effective. You know, if you really want to lose weight, you can go on a very extreme diet. You have to take in some protein for health, but you can go virtually without food for a long time. And again, if you're 20 years old and you stand up from the table and you almost pass out, that's an experience. When you get older, it doesn't have that kick. So,
It's true. I can remember. I think that this comes back to your idea of like, if you're okay, you're okay. But, you know, some people, I didn't get fat, but I definitely had a problem with carbohydrates. And it wasn't till I stuck my finger with one of those lancets and put a drop of blood onto a test strip that I really understood that I wasn't okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, well, we're always advised to get medical checkups. It's an unrealistic recommendation, but that doesn't mean it's bad.
Right.
But were you, did you have diabetes or do you now?
Well, I don't know. I never got that diagnosis, but I was consistently waking up with a fasted blood glucose of 120 milligrams per deciliter. So definitely not a good place. And I know now that I'm really sensitive to carbohydrates. Like I can't tolerate very much at all without going back to that place. And, you know, I think I made a lifetime of bad decisions, but it was the sugary sports supplements that I was pounding down as an athlete. I raced at the elite level on a mountain bike, and that definitely didn't help me. I really put myself into a very bad place consuming those. So, yeah, that's what happened.
Yeah. Well, the final part that I was going to say is that, well, on the second part, I said that, you know, if you want to lose weight, don't eat. Mm-hmm. I said that as a joke, but there's something to it. You don't have to eat all the time. The real point, though, is if you're going to diet, you need to do a low carbohydrate diet for the first shot, because that's going to be the easiest. But again, for different people, when you're younger, just about anything will work. The other thing that's of real import in that idea is that the low glycemic index is really a politically correct version of low carbohydrate diets, and it's strictly in third place on that scale. But the third part of those recommendations is, if you have diabetes or clearly metabolic syndrome, you really have to try a low-carbohydrate diet first, because that's what the science says. You know, it's I have no stake in this. If anything, my career would be a lot better off if I didn't indicate the benefits of a low carbohydrate diet. But that's what you need to do. That's what the science says. And in my view, it's one of the worst scandals in the history of medicine that people are, physicians are continuing to recommend carbohydrate for people with diabetes.
Right. So how do you, you know, if I was to send you a new paper and it was a nutritional study, you know, I'm interested to know how you go about reading it, or even deciding that it's worth reading. And the first thing, and it popped up. You're a great guy to follow on Facebook, by the way. Go find Richard on Facebook. He posts some really really fun, interesting stuff that's definitely got me engaged. But one of the points you raised recently is on citations. Like, can you do that? Are you allowed not to cite someone else's work? So if someone else has shown something, can you then go on and write another paper that completely ignores it? Can you do that?
Yeah, you certainly can. Whether you should is a different question. The whole mess here is due to that. The only thing that you can say is that there are hundreds of journals. We have a new nutrition journal every week. I mean, that really is probably an accurate description, not an exaggeration. And what happens is that nobody can read all the papers. People tend to read the major journals like New England Journal and American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And these editorial boards are so highly biased, and in some cases, so totally ignorant. I mean, the New England Journal must be a major journal in real medicine. In nutrition, it publishes stuff that I wouldn't accept from an undergraduate. And so that's a real problem. So you can see why people would not latch on to any paper that was outside of the half a dozen things that they read. So that's giving an excuse to the low-fat people, but it's not a good excuse. They're at fault. I usually discuss this by analogy with the courts of law. And in a court of law, there is what's called Brady material, which refers to exculpatory evidence. And Brady was convicted of murder and sentenced to death. He got his sentence reduced because he showed that his accomplice, who had actually accomplished, had actually done the murder, had made a confession, which was not introduced in his trial. You can't do that. You can't leave out exculpatory evidence. And courts have ruled you can't even look the other way. You can't even not look at the journals you don't like. If they're serious journals, you got to read them. So that's one of the problems we have. So you have, and what that means is that you'll find a paper that says a high-fat diet is detrimental because it raises blood glucose, it raises cholesterol, whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you read the paper, you'll see that it's a high-fat diet that's also high in carbohydrate. And you have to ask, well, suppose it's low in carbohydrate, because we're really providing the alternative. And under those conditions, things get better, not worse. So, you know, that's the major, one of the major problems in the literature is that they refer to high-fat diets without saying what else is going on there. I mean, partly that's due to poor definitions. High-fat diet covers a range of fat and therefore a range of carbohydrate that's not really informative.
Right. That's one of my, you know, as a layperson on the outside, that's one of my biggest problems is the weakness of the definition. And then you can be even more specific and say a ketogenic diet and it's still be not really saying anything at all, right? So for what is ketogenic for one person is not ketogenic for the next. And it still doesn't tell you anything about what type of fats the person ate or whether they were meeting their full requirements of the micronutrients. And I think that's a real problem. And you presented an idea in Latin, which I won't try and pronounce now, but it translates to show me the body of the data. So is that something that you always look for when you see a new study? Are you always looking to see whether they describe exactly what's eaten, or do you think that's not necessary?
Oh, no, that's, of course, absolutely necessary. My recent blog post describes a paper, the first author is Gary Foster, and that's very important because he did what I describe as, he did the experiment that I described as the shot heard round the world by analogy with the American Revolution, because there he says in public, he gave a lecture in which he said they set out to trash the Atkins diet. And, well, that's not the best way to do research. But in any case, what he found was that he couldn't trash it. In fact, it did better than the low-fat diet. And he did a follow-up. That was a one-year study. He did a follow-up of a two-year study whose conclusion was that only calories count. It doesn't matter about the macronutrient composition of the diet. So I describe in the book how a student was annoyed that I dismissed that paper without reading it very carefully. And I tried to explain that I'm a professional. It's I can get in there and look at it fast and tell you it's not a good paper. Well, obviously, this was not particularly convincing. So I had to go back and read the paper in detail. First thing I noticed is it was very long. So that was already suspicious. It had a lot of words, but not a lot of data. And so what I looked for first, well, let me answer the question that you asked before. What do I look for first in the paper is the pictures. I know that sounds funny, but we call them figures in a scientific paper. But the presence and the quality of the figures will tell you a lot about a scientific paper. Because for most scientific studies, I know this is an extreme generalization, the figures will give you more information than the tables. It's not universal. There's nothing really universal in science, but that's a good rule. In fact, the way a lot of people write scientific papers, me included, is you make up the figures and then you write the text around them. You know, you lay them out to see what the story is. You know, a good scientific paper, even a good mathematical paper, is a story. And if you can't write a good story, then that's suspicious. Now, of course, a lot of scientific things are technical, so it can't be, it's not going to be a story that everybody can read, but it should have some literary impact. I mean, you should take the trouble to explain things. I quote in the book what I call the golden rule of statistics, which statistics itself is a major problem in the literature. And it says you should make it clear to the reader that the burden of proof is on the author to make it clear to the reader what's going on. And if you don't do that, as they say, if the study isn't clear before you do the statistics, you should be suspicious. So what I look at first are the figures. So coming back to Foster's paper, the figures were a little odd. The titles of them were predicted values, which I don't know Latin, but I think everybody knows habeas corpus, which means let us have the body. So I morphed that into habeas corpus datorum, let us have the body of the data. I quote this from a statistics book, which says before the statistical shenanigans begin, that's what you should do. So anyway, with Foster's paper, I started to look for the primary data, which in the case of a diet study is always how much carbohydrate, how much protein, how much fat. Well, I couldn't find it. And as I say, it was a very long paper because it went into great detail about how they counseled people. I think this was a reaction to the fact that their first paper, they just gave people the Atkins book and said, go out there and do this. But anyway, I couldn't find any of those, and I was about to call Foster when I saw somebody's blog found an article in the LA Times by a reporter named Bob Kaplan, and he had written to Foster and to Jim Hill, who was one of the authors. They hadn't measured this. I mean, it's kind of astounding. He described it. Kaplan described it as what any high school student would know to do first or something like that. So, you know, it was just outrageous.
It seems then if the data's not there, then probably they don't know. It's unlikely that they've withheld something. It's probably that they just didn't measure it to begin with.
Well, I think they were... what they said is true. They didn't measure it.
Right.
And what that means is that once you find that out, now, admittedly, they are at fault at a minimum. They're at fault for not saying that they didn't measure. You can't just not measure and leave it out. I mean, that's like, well, I don't think it's Brady material, but it would be some fault if you brought that to a court of law. But anyway, it means that their conclusion is not justified by their data. So why do you have to do that kind of work to find out that the paper's no good? And the answer is because that's what you got to do. You know, I can't tell you. I think nutrition is very important, and for many people it can be critical. And you do have to do that work. The other side of it is that you do have to learn something about chemistry. And, you know, our educational system is a little lax in that area. The chemical curriculum, as it's done in high school and college, doesn't get people up to speed on what they want to know right away, and they could. So that's one of the things I tried to do in my book, is give you at least a rough idea of what goes on in biochemistry. Mm-hmm. The reason it took me a long time to write the book is that it's really three books. I mean, you really have to. You have to know the chemistry, and I could only do it in a rough sort of way. And then you have to know the nutrition. And between those two, you can see what's going on in the politics. And so the sequel to my book is three books, which I'm working on now.
Oh, wow. It's one of the things I meant to mention, actually, was how bold you were in the amount of ground that you covered. It's the sort of everything from, you know, the kind of the history of how we got to where we are now through laws of thermodynamics, through there's even a section on recipes on the end. I couldn't believe it. So it really is three books in one, but I enjoyed all of it immensely. So I realize from what you've just been saying that I've been making a critical error, and that's to, you know, whenever I see one of these PDFs of some nutritional study and I want to read it, the first thing I do is I send it to my Kindle, which is quite a primitive black and white device that doesn't render pictures at all. And so all I've been reading is the text, and I don't really look at the figures, and even the tables on that device are not rendered very well. And so that's that I see now is a problem. But you know,
look at the figures first, and then, the author, the burden is on the author to make the figures clear. And if they don't do that, they're already coming from behind. It's already suspicious.
Right. So that's something you said in the book, which I thought was really interesting, that, you know, presentation in graphic form means that the author is trying to explain something to you. So if the pictures are really good and you spend some time looking at those, then you know that the story is worth reading. So I think that's a really helpful piece of advice. But as far as the body of the data, I'm really interested to know what you think is enough. Like, so you just mentioned the macronutrient ratios. Do you not care about what type of fat was consumed? You know, if they're just, you know, drinking a whole bunch of polyunsaturated seed oil versus...
Well, it depends on what the question is.
Okay. Okay. You
know, if the data show that fat on, you know, poorly described by the author, has a particular effect, better or worse, and the data is clear. You know, the data doesn't rely on small statistical changes. Then you got to go to the next question and say, well, what will happen if it's different kind of fat? And but you know, you can't answer every question all at once. So you know, in that sense, it's always about what question's being asked. And that's why, you know, one of the things that I criticize in the book is this idea that is common in the medical literature, that there's, you know, standards of evidence, different types of studies that are better or worse. And that's not really part of science. That's made up by people who don't have real experience. The idea that a random controlled trial is a gold standard, which you see in the literature, depends on what you're trying to find out. Sometimes a random controlled trial is not what you need. Sometimes you need a short trial, small number of people, but clear-cut data, because the bigger the N, the more people you have in the study, the longer the study goes, the more unreliable the data become, because you don't know who's conforming to the protocol and who isn't, and so on. So I don't think there's any fixed approach. The answer is, again, because I'm working on a paper now describing an analogy between courts of law and what they call evidence-based medicine, the courts have spent a lot of effort trying to decide what constitutes scientific evidence. And basically, a lot of it derives from what are called the federal rules of evidence, which were laid out by Congress. And the bottom line is that evidence is admissible in a court of law if it helps, you know, if it really is relevant to the question at hand. So that's really the question. We don't have there aren't cut and dry rules of science. So enough data is enough for you to make a decision. But it's got to be, the reason I made up that rule that we have to have the whole body of the data is that frequently what you'll see in epidemiologic data is data that's already been manipulated. And I gave a couple examples in the book and in my blog where you have data that's already been gone through the computer and finds a particular thing. But if you look at the raw data, it actually goes the other way. And, you know, that's not legitimate, or at least it's not easy to accept without a lot of explanation.
So you should look out for that then, if you sort of, if the author dives straight into hazard ratios and all these kinds of sophisticated statistical techniques that are difficult to understand, it's not a good sign.
That's a good rule. Okay. I mean, as I say, there are technical issues, mm-hmm. but you know, I teach partly because we had a number of foreign graduate students. I used to teach a course on scientific writing. And I used to ask, and it includes scientific presentation as well. And I said, what are you supposed to do in a scientific paper or in a scientific presentation? And students would try to come up with convoluted explanations. And, you know, that's the kind of question that a professor asks you, and it's so incredibly annoying. So I tried not to carry it out too long. Finally, I said, well, just give me in one word what you're supposed to do. And the answer is teach. Mm-hmm. That's the main thing you're supposed to do. You know, when you give a scientific paper, you should not be trying to snow the editor. You should mm-hmm. not be trying, especially, not to snow the audience. You should be trying to explain things. Mm-hmm. Now, it is true that you're also selling. You have to make your idea cogent. But first, you're teaching.
Yeah, I think that's important. And it's, for someone like me, it's incredibly easy to snow me, right? Because I'm, you know, I don't know much about chemistry and nutrition and biochemistry. And I'm smart enough to know that I don't know much. And so when it's easy, like if you hit me with some stuff like that, I'm just going to say, oh, well, I guess I just don't know. But it might actually, he might not actually be right.
Well, and I would never know. It's easy to snow me, and part of the problem is it's easy to snow yourself. I mean, I don't think a lot of the stuff in the medical literature that's so terrible is quite honest. They don't see fallacies. And, you know, I'm not saying it from on high. We all make five mistakes a week. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the essence of doing science. Maybe what is the difference between science and medicine is in medicine, you don't have that privilege to make a lot of mistakes, and you don't, for that reason, you're disinclined to admit mistakes when you do make them. But I always say, and it's not really false modesty, my wisdom is like Socrates. My wisdom consists of in knowing how little I know about most of these questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's an important point. And so what am I to do then? That's kind of, we've had this long discussion. So do you think it's like a complete waste of time for me to try and just read some random paper that I found somewhere on the internet, say,
and then clearly you should read my book first.
Your book first, which I've done. But I'm just wondering, you know, like which papers I should read. You know, we've discussed that there's some problems with the major journals, and also they're probably quite expensive for someone like me, and so that might not be the answer either. So, what do you think should be my first point of contact when I'm looking to read a study? I'll tell you what's been helpful so far. At least I think it's been helpful. Is I've met a number of doctors that I respect over the past year or so, mostly through this podcast, actually, and those people have been really helpful in sending me papers which are of a good quality and relevant to what I'm doing. And I found that extremely useful. Of course, I don't really know what they're not sending me, but so what would you do? What would you recommend to someone like me? What should be my first point of contact?
Well, it's a very good question. I'm not sure. I could tell you what I think you should read first. And, I think the major people in low carbohydrate research are the people you should follow up. Let me give you one place to start. I mean, usually what you want is a reliable review article that has enough different points to follow up. So I will send you a paper that we wrote in the journal called Nutrition, came out in January, and it's about diabetes, and it has the 12 points of evidence that support the use of low-carbohydrate diets as the first line of approach in treating diabetes. And what I would do there is go through the 12 points of evidence, you know, go back, you know, it is a scientific paper. It's not written specifically for laymen. On the other hand, it is tries to be as straightforward as possible, and go through each of those points and see what our arguments are, and ask yourself, if I were buying this, you know, if I really had diabetes and I were really concerned, would I buy this piece of evidence? And if not, what's missing? And then that gives you something to ask, the next person on your podcast or the next person that you meet. And then each of the points, it's really not a false modesty when I say that I'm the senior author on the paper. It's not false modesty when I say that what I really did there was to organize major work by the other authors. And, you know, their contribution is what's most important. So, and nobody writes one paper. So follow up those authors. If you think the, and I think, I don't remember exactly, but I think we tried to include at least one figure for every one of the main points. It is a traditional journal in the sense that it comes out in a hardbound version. We did make it, with those journals, you have to pay to make it open access, but it is open access, and you can see it online. We also think that color figures were important, so we also had to pay to have the figures in color. So, you know, given those two, we were sort of limited by how many figures we could have, but we tried to have at least one for every major point, and look at those and ask what's the follow-up, and what have the authors done themselves to follow up on those points.
Okay, and so for people listening, is this the Journal of Nutrition and Metabolism?
Okay, it's the journal is called Nutrition. It's volume 31, and it's page one, actually, the journal. We're the first one in the journal.
Excellent.
And it has 26 authors.
Oh, wow, okay.
So it's so it's authoritative.
Okay. So when you've got one expert, that's good. When you've got 26, it's presumably better.
Well, I would say most people, you probably don't even have to be in science to understand that compared to getting agreement among 26 authors,
right?
That's peer review is nothing compared to that.
Right. And then finally, I wanted to ask you, which is your favorite biochemistry kind of undergraduate level text, something that I could read to sort of get a better understanding of this stuff?
The strategy is simple. Just find out what the biology text being used by your neighboring university is. And I'm trying to think of the authors. Like I said, it's not a course that I actually teach, but... Mm-hmm. But anyway, the introductory chapters of most of the good biology texts are very good. And the big biology texts for big university courses are very good. They are not affordable, but the earlier editions are perfectly good, and they are affordable. So, I mean, even one that's 20 years old will get you right into... good biochemistry. I mean, there's no Marxist chemistry, there's no Christian chemistry, there's just chemistry.
Right.
So that would be my recommendation. If you want to go up to the next level, of course, you have to recognize you're buying a book for the first 25 pages. But as I say, the old editions tend to be very affordable. And of course, the texts themselves are very good. They branch off into all kinds of biology that you may not want to know right away. So that would be my recommendation.
Excellent. Those are some fantastic tips. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your time.
And then the best-selling biochemistry text that our students use is by Harvey. It's called the Lippincott book because it's published by Lippincott. It's a review book, but it's really very good and very thorough, except on nutrition. And one of the early editions described how obesity increased as the amount of carbohydrate in the diet increased. And the book said, "This has led some uncritical observers to say that carbohydrate was fattening." So I wrote to the author and I said, well, I'm one of those uncritical observers. I have to give a lecture and they look in the book and says uncritical observers. So I said, I think you better change that for the next edition. So the next edition said that this has caused some observers to say that carbohydrate is fattening. So I guess that's as much as I could. Harvey himself actually, well, like I say, it's a very good book. I don't think he put a lot of care into figuring out whether low carb really is important. But the major texts are all very good. Some of them, you know, take the party line on nutrition in some places where they don't have the time to sort it out for themselves. But where it bears on the biochemistry, they're very good on citing relevant material, and they make it clear. So I mean, these texts are encyclopedic. I personally can't imagine how some of them are multi-authored, but even so, I can't imagine how people produce it.
Yeah, that was, I have the Marx Medical Biochemistry book, which I just got. And yeah, that was my first thought when I saw it. I'm like, my God, how long does it take someone to produce this? And you see that it's multiple authors, but even so, it's not surprising that some of it's out of date.
Yeah, and you know, it's not surprising that especially given how much effort was put into selling the low-fat propaganda.
Right.
It's not it's not surprising that they would just cut and paste that in. I mean, that's really the problem in medicine, is that my own internist many years ago said he didn't know nutrition, he didn't have time to learn it, and he sent his patients to a dietitian. He did come to our low carb conference, and he said it really opened his eyes. But he still didn't feel like he was an expert. So that is part of the problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, I can remember reading that in the book that a medical degree is not any guarantee of expertise outside of your area of specialty.
And you should. We have to recognize that that expertise in that area can be tremendous. I mean, that's part of the problem here, is that modern medicine is very powerful. And the flip side of how good it is might be how easy it is to think that you know everything. I think it's hard for somebody who's just done the multiple bypass to admit that they're not sure about what's the best thing to eat.
Right. Well, this has been very enlightening, and thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. I'll find these, I'll hunt these books down and link to them in the show notes so that people can find them easily.
Okay, great.
Cheers then. Thanks, Richard.
Okay, thank you.